Thank you, Jorge. So today I'm going to talk about a paper that recently appeared 2 weeks ago on Archive. So as you can see, the title of this paper, of this talk, suggests that I'm going to talk about something that shows up a nice interplay between, you know, fundamental theoretical ideas from quantum gravity and observational facts that has been gathered by recent observations. So over the past few years in LQC, as you might have heard in several talks and panel discussions, that there's a point of view, or rather conclusion, has emerged that the contrary to popular belief, the pre-inflationary dynamics is not completely washed away by inflation. And in the past few years, several pieces of work have shown that perturbations actually do keep memory of the bounds. And not only that, in this talk, I would like to convince you by the end of the talk that these imprints that perturbations gather from bounds can actually be seen in observations, and that can have some interesting consequences for late-time cosmology as well. So go to the next slide. So the recent observations by Planck and WMAP have taught us a great deal about cosmology. In particular, we learned that lambda CDM model works extremely well at very large scale. In particular, the measurements of the cosmic microwave background have put strong constraints on cosmological parameters, such as the Hubble rate today, matter constitution, and so on and so forth. And on this slide, you can see this beautiful picture of cosmic microwave background, where the colors, blue and yellow colors, show tens of microkelvin fluctuations on fluctuations in temperature on the surface of glass scattering. And the story doesn't stop here. At the moment, there are many next generation CMB observation missions have been planned to measure the CMB more precisely, in particular, the polarization spectrum and non-Gaussianity at very large scales. And of course, they are going to teach us more about late-time cosmology, and we can have more precise measurement on things. At the same time, cosmology offers the best chance of testing the direct quantum gravity effects in the foreseeable future, because these cosmic inhomogeneities seen in the CMB can be affected by the early universe dynamics, and where quantum gravity effects are important. So one should take this as an opportunity to connect with, ideas from quantum gravity to observations. In particular, we go to next slide. In particular, one of the greatest triumphs, in my opinion, of inflationary paradigm is to explain the origin of this cosmic inhomogeneities that we see in the CMB. According to inflation, these thermal fluctuations that we see in the CMB originate from the quantum vacuum fluctuations in the very early universe. And during inflation, these quantum vacuum fluctuations get stretched to very large scales at cosmological scales, which then seed the formation of large scale structure in later universe. Using the ideas the framework of quantum field theory in Kurt background, one can make predictions in this paradigm. One can compute the statistical properties of these fluctuations that one will see in the CMB. And recent observations such as from Planck 2015 mission, as you can see in this plot, that the predictions of lambda CDM plus inflation, they are in remarkable agreement with observations, mostly at scale, angular scale corresponding to L larger than 30. So this is a triumphant in some sense. However, there are some limitations which have come into picture after very precise measurements by recent observations. So the first limitation, which has to do with observation, go to the next slide, is known as the large-scale CMB anomalies. Here I show the recent paper by Planck, Isotropy in Statistics of the CMB. And in the abstract, I've highlighted two main important points that are relevant for the CMB anomalies. The first point brings out a feature in the power spectrum is that at scales, at very large scales, corresponding to multiple less than 30, there is less power than what one expected from lambda cesium plus inflationary scenario. The second anomaly that one sees is that, there is a dipolar power asymmetry in the CMB. That is, in one part of the sky, there is more power than the other, and the difference of the power is approximately 14%. So while these anomalies, there is a reason why this, these are called anomalies, not features, because the statistical significance of these phenomena are debatable in the sense that they are at the borderline between being accepted as a feature or not anomaly. But there is a, in cosmology community, there is a wide belief in some sense that this could be coming from some fundamental physics. And I have extracted one paragraph from the introduction of this paper where the highlighted sentence says that such anomalies have attracted considerable attention in the community since they could be the visible traces of fundamental physics physics processes occurring in the early universe. So this, for us, is a great opportunity to, yes. This.
Can you show us these anomalies on the graph?
The last slide.
Oh, yeah, the last slide, okay. Yeah, so in
so go to the last slide.
Yeah, so go to the last slide, slide number three. The question is, can you see these anomalies in the graph? So in this graph, we can see for the first anomaly, that is power suppression. So if you look at the top panel of the figure, the observational data, the data points are, most of them, they clutter below the red line. So in this sense, there is a less power at this scale on average than the predicted one. Yes.
Regarding L less than 30, you have cosmic variance, which you can't get rid of.
Yeah. So the question is, at less than at the scale less than at less than 30, there is these features are dominated by cosmic variance, and how you get rid of them. So I mean, just by looking at the temperature power spectrum. It's very hard to get rid of them. So that is one of the reasons why these this phenomena is anomalies, because of cosmic variance, the statistical significance of them is not so strong. But when you look at, you can, what you can do is you can look at the temperature correlation, and you know, and together with polarization spectrum, where still, there will be some cosmic variance, but by looking at the correlation between temperature and polarization spectrum, you can get a better statistical significance on these features, and you can say whether these are actually features or not.
The dipole's not there.
Say again.
The dipole anomaly is not.
Yeah. So dipole anomaly is not apparent on, in this figure. For that, you have to look at the actual sky map. Okay. So coming back to slide number four, I was saying that these anomalies provide us an opportunity to connect the ideas from quantum gravity to observations. Go to next slide. So, so there are some theoretical limitations on the inflationary paradigm as well. The first limitation comes from the fact that an inflationary paradigm is based on classical general relativity. And if one evolves the universe using Einstein equation in the past, the trajectories go to Big Bang singularity, and geodesics cannot be extended anymore. So while inflation works very well and so on, it's past incomplete. Moreover, during in the inflationary paradigm, what one does is that one sees that during inflation, the space-time is approximately de-Sitter. That is, the Hubble rate changes very slowly, and appealing to this de-Sitter, approximate de-Sitter symmetry, one assumes that when before the modes exit the curvature radius during inflation, they are in the Bunch-Davis state. So as a zeroth order or even first order work, this works extremely well. But when you now we are at the moment of precision, more and more precision cosmology. So we should look at all the aspects of theory as we can. So although there is approximate Disser symmetry, Hubble rate does change from time to time. So in this sense, considering these perturbations in Bunch-Davy state at one instant of time is different from considering Bunch-Davy state at a different instant of time. And then there is an ambiguity related to at what instant of time do you give the initial conditions in Bunch-Davy state. Furthermore, what is more relevant for this talk is that assuming that the perturbations are in Bunch-Davy state ignores any pre-inflationary dynamics. It ignores the possibility that there could be something going on in the pre-inflationary dynamics that can create excitations over the Bunch-Davy state, and that is not considered in the current inflationary paradigm. Go to the next slide. So the goal of this talk is to address these limitations of standard inflation by invoking pre-inflationary dynamics of loop quantum cosmology. So what we are going to do is we'll work with flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker model with an inflationary potential. So we'll in this work we have looked at both inflationary potential, both the Stravinsky and quadratic potential. But for most simulations, I'll only stick to Stravinsky potential, and the results, final results, do not care much about what the inflationary potential is. We'll study the pre-inflationary dynamics of LQC and see how quantum perturbations evolve on them, and in order to compute the power spectrum. So in this talk, I'm going to introduce two new elements, that is, two new physical principles in order to select or fix the initial condition for the background geometry and Heisenberg state for quantum perturbations, invoking the dynamics in the Planck regime. And in the end, what we find is that the resulting power spectrum agrees extremely well with the standard predictions at L larger than 30 and provides better fit to data at large scale corresponding to L multiple less than 30. And we see that there will be some suppression of power. Using this power, this framework, one can also calculate the consequences of polarization spectrum, and as we'll see, there is also testable predictions for polarization spectrum as well. Okay, so let's go to next slide. Let's get started. So I'm not going to give too much introduction about loop quantum cosmology because LQC has been discussed in many talks and panel discussions in loop quantum gravity seminars, but I'll highlight the main ingredients of LQC that will be relevant for this talk. So the framework that we are going to work with will contain a background geometry denoted by big psi naught, that which is the solution of the quantum Hamiltonian constraint of LQC without any perturbations. And then we'll consider quantum perturbations denoted by little psi, which propagate on this quantum background big psi naught as test fields. Okay. So a decade ago, the first explorations in loop quantum cosmology, which dealt with only the background state big psi naught, revealed that in LQC, if one tracks the evolution of psi naught, one sees that the Big Bang singularity that was there in the classical theory is resolved and replaced by a quantum bounce. As you can see in this cartoon picture, when one evolves today's universe all the way back to the quantum gravity regime, because of quantum geometry, there is a bounce. Moreover, building on these work and using the so-called effective description of loop quantum cosmology, various people have shown that given an inflationary potential the inflationary paradigm can be very easily, or naturally rather, accommodated in the picture of the bounds, and there are natural initial conditions on the both on the background geometry and the matter field, which is a scalar field in this case, which leads to inflation compatible with observations. Then, over the recent past five or six years, there has been a lot of progress in understanding how quantum perturbations will evolve on this quantum modified background geometry, and so there has been several different approaches to attack this problem. In this talk, I'm going to stick with the dressmetric approach, where one says that the quantum fields, nil and psi, propagate on quantum geometry big psi naught in such a way that the propagation of perturbation can be captured by a dress metric, an effective dress metric, which is computed from big psi naught in very precise sense. Okay. And for concreteness, I'm going to consider sharply peaked states, sharply peaked background states, for which the dress metric can be extremely well approximated by effective dynamics. I mean, one can, one is free, and one can actually take more complicated states, the states which are widely spread, not sharply peaked to begin with, and one can easily do the computations. But here, our approach is more phenomenological, and we want to calculate the leading order effects, so we'll stick to sharply peaked states. Okay, go to the next slide. So in this framework, what I've described in the previous slide, there is a tremendous freedom in choice of the initial conditions. For instance, in this framework, nobody tells me what is the value of Ilfeton field at the bounds going to be that will give you inflation. There is actually there is a big range of possibilities, and also we don't know what is the Heisenberg state for the perturbations in the Planck regime. So in order to fix this freedom, we are going to introduce two new elements. The first element, which I denote as principle one, where we fix the background geometry using some observational facts that has been gathered by Planck data and some elements of quantum geometry. In principle two, we'll fix the Heisenberg state for quantum perturbations using a quantum generalization of Penrose's wide curvature hypothesis and Planck scale dynamics of LQC. So in both principles, we use some elements of LQC together with some other ideas in order to fix our background geometry and state for perturbation. Going to next slide. So let's begin with the principle one, fixing the background geometry. So in order to do that, let's recall some facts from observations. So recent Planck data have taught us, told us very precisely what is the value of H naught, which is the Hubble parameter today, omega matter and omega lambda. So using these numbers, one can map the evolution of the background geometry in the post-CMB era very precisely. So, and in this way, the evolution of space-time to the future of CMB is completely fixed. So this conformal diagram here shows exactly that. So T naught is the time corresponding to today, and it's a general convention to assume that the scale factor equal to 1 today. And if you trace the past light cone of an observer corresponding to today, it intersects the CMB surface at a finite distance, which is 12.63 megaparsec, and that is the size of this, that is the part of the CMB that we see today. But from these numbers that Planck has given us, we see that omega lambda is omega lambda, which corresponds to dark energy or cosmological constant, is going to dominate in future. And due to this positive cosmological constant, if you trace in future, if you look at the future evolution, an eternal observer has a past horizon. That is, an observer corresponding to t equal to infinity. So t is the proper time here. And if one calculates the conformal time in this picture, there's going to be a the conformal time at t equal to infinity is going to be finite. And if you trace the past line code of an eternal observer, that is going to intersect the CMB surface at approximately 17.29 megaparsec. So this is a big revelation that no matter how long you wait, no matter how far in future you go, you cannot see more CMB than 17 megaparsec. Okay, so that is the entire past horizon of an eternal observer is contained in this two sphere S2 CMB of the radius 17 megaparsec. Now, the task that is in front of us is to actually see how this S2 CMB evolves back all the way up to Planck scale. So what we are going to do is to understand its dynamics in the Planck scale, we'll look at quantum geometry and see what are the possibilities in the Planck regime at the bounds. So for that, let's go to the next slide. So this is where the elements of quantum geometry come. So the simplest network spin network underlying this quantum geometry that one considers in NQC is given by a cubical graph. So a cubical graph which has edges along x, y, and z direction. So and a dual of this graph, this cubical graph with these edges, is shown on the left of the figure, where the spatial manifold can be decomposed in terms of these cubical cells. On the right-hand side, we show these edges which intersect the cubes, this cubical cell on the faces. And so one consider what is the smallest two sphere that can be contained in the simplest graph. So that smallest sphere would be contained in this cubical cell. So the idea is to look at what is the size of this sphere. Okay. So as you can see, there are six edges intersecting the cubical cell. So it's a six-node graph, and each edge is going to posit since we are looking at the simplest model, each edge has a spin half, j equal to half. So each edge is going to correspond to an area corresponding to the minimum area gap, which is denoted by delta here. So in total, the surface area of this two sphere is going to be 6 times delta, which after you put in the numbers, it comes down to be approximately 31 Planck length square. Okay. Now we go to next slide. The physical principle that we introduce here is that, remember, the size of the ever observable CMB sphere S2 CMB that we saw in the two slides back emerges from the simplest two sphere that one can consider in quantum cosmology at the bounds. So the sphere of the simplest area at the bounds was 31 Planck length square, and one can calculate the radius easily. It turns out to be 1.57 Planck length. So the idea is that the CMB surface, as shown in this conformal diagram here, the Rmax CMB of 17.29 megaparsec comes or emerges from 1.57 Planck length at the bounds. So using this principle, one can easily fix. So this fixes exactly how many number of e-folds there are from bounds till CMB. Okay. And we know that from CMB till today, the evolution is completely fixed by observations. So from today till the bounds, the number of e-folds are fixed. It's approximately 141.5 e-folds. And given, so in this, in fixing this initial, bound surface, we did not use any inflationary potential. So this is, this principle is independent of what the dynamics is in between bounds and CMB. And now if one considers a particular inflationary potential, then that, this principle actually fixes the background geometry or initial value of inflation field at the bounds. And the background geometry is exactly fixed. There is no free parameter anymore. So if you go to next slide.
So can I just ask what happened here? You fix the 1.57 Planck length at the beginning there,
yeah.
And then you calculated the 141.5, is that right?
Yeah.
So that's the time to make it match.
That's it.
That's the elapsed time to make the diagram match.
Yeah, so what we are simply doing is that at the bounds, we know, like you said, that the size is 1.57 Planck length,
yeah,
and we know the size at this instant.
Okay,
so we just, you divide and take that number of e4s, essentially. Okay, so it, so what is the consequence of, so now, right now we are at slide number 12. So let's look at some consequences of fixing this initial condition on the background geometry. And that can be summarized in these two figures that I show here. And these figures I'm sure you have seen many times, but here I want to extract some useful information. So the first figure that shows the energy density of the scalar, oh, there should be scalar field there. So the main figure shows the proper time or cosmic time on x-axis, and y-axis shows the energy density in Planck units. And as you can see that in approximately 10 to the 7 Planck seconds, energy density falls from the maximum to the inflationary scale at t equal to t star, and inflation happens. If you look at the inset figure in the energy density, it shows the evolution of energy density in the first 15 Planck seconds on the either side of the bounds. So in this first 10 to 15 Planck seconds, already the energy density drops below 10 to the minus 4 Planck density. And there, after at that time, I mean, the classical GR is already works quite well. So the Planck regime is actually contained in only the first 10 to 15 seconds. And
keep saying 10 seconds, 10 to 15 sounds like 10 to the power 15.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So not 10 to the 15, 10, let's stick to 10 Planck seconds, thank you. 10 Planck seconds. And if I look at the evolution of number of e-folds, or in other words, scale factor, in the second figure, in 10 Planck seconds, the scale factor, number of e-folds goes from 0 to 1.2. So in during this time, there's only 1.2 e-folds in the Planck regime. And it's quite small. Nonetheless, we'll see that this small Planck regime, which has only 1.2 e-folds, is enough to leave imprints on, leave observable imprints on the power spectrum, and we can see in the CMB. Another important consequence of this fixing background geometry is that bounds is extremely kinetic energy dominated. That is to say, for these initial conditions, given inflationary potential, one can compute what is the kinetic energy and potential energy at the bounds, and it turns out the kinetic energy is much higher than potential energy. So in the Planck regime, the scalar field behaves very much like a massless scalar field. And this is very good news for LQC, because most of the full quantization of loop quantum cosmology and numerical evolution of states and so on have been performed in using massless scalar fields. So all that framework can be imported here. And so in this sense, there is a coherence of ideas within LQC. And since the field is massless scalar field, one can, if one wants, instead of using proper time, like I've done here in the effective dynamics, one can stick to scalar, the emergent time, the scalar field as time, and repeat all these calculations and get the same answer as we're getting here. Yes?
can't rely on is the extrapolation from the CMP, the surface of last scattering, to t equal to zero.
T equal to, like today? They are very reliable. They're
extrapolating to t equal to zero to get the geometry.
So t equal to zero, you mean at the bound, till the bounds?
Yeah.
So it's not an extrapolation. I mean, you give initial conditions to the bounds, and you evolve using LQC equations, so it's fixed. There is no ambiguity there. And
the local value of each node has just been remeasured, and it's 3.5 sigma away from the CMP value for each node. So, in other words, there's something, if this is correct, there's something wrong with FRW. You can't have this.
Yeah, so I think that's a completely separate issue. Here I'm...
But the point is that you're relying on FRW to be exact to get your result.
Yeah, so this model assumes that we are working with FRW model.
That's the assumption, okay.
That's the assumption, and yeah.
It may not be correct, anyway.
It may not be correct, but like most of the solutions tell us, for the most part, it works fine. So I'm going to assume that is the case. Okay, so now we go to the next slide. I'm going to talk about principle two in order to fix Heisenberg state for perturbations. So to fix the state for perturbation, what we are going to use is so-called Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis. So originally, the wild curvature hypothesis was formulated in the classical GR. So where once Penrose says that the initial singularity is very simple in the sense that wild curvature goes to zero while DC curvature blows up. And that tells us that in classical GR, the universe has a very special very special condition close to singularity. But here we are not working with the classical GR. We have a quantum spacetime that resolves the singularity. And top of that, we have quantum perturbations. So since the electric and magnetic part of the Wien tensor have non-trivial Poisson bracket, in quantum gravity, I cannot say that the wild curvature will go to zero. Right? Because that will violate Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So, what is the next best thing we can do? What is the simplest generalization or quantum generalization of wild curvature hypothesis one can do? And that is that follows as follows. That we say that while the expectation values of energy, the electric and magnetic parts of the wild tensor vanish, the uncertainties in the electric and magnetic parts are equally distributed, they are equal to each other in appropriate units, and the product is minimized. So this is the simplest quantum generalization of Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis. Now we are working with scalar perturbations here. So in Heisenberg picture, the formulation of wild curvature hypothesis for scalar perturbation gives us three conditions that I have shown here. So the first condition, so these modes QK is basically like a massless scalar field propagating on the FRW background, and QK is the same as Mukhano-Sasaki variable that one uses to compute two-point function and observable predictions and so on. And pi K, of course, is the conjugate momentum of QK. So the first condition is kind of trivial from the fact that expectation value of electric and magnetic parts vanish. So expectation value of QK and pi K are zero, and this is consistent with the fact that one works with quasi-free states for perturbations. The second condition says that the product of uncertainties are minimized. And the third condition which is the more strong condition, which says that the sum of these uncertainties are also minimum at a given time. Since this is we are working in a dynamical background, all these statements depend on time. So they are, it turns out that they give us a unique Heisenberg state at a given instant. So we get an unique instantaneous state by imposing these conditions. As a side remark, is that a question? No. Okay. As a side remark, what one can do is like, okay, I'm going to do a mathematical exercise where I want to impose this condition in Minkowski space, just because I like Minkowski space. So it turns out that in that case, these conditions give you unique state, and that is exactly same as the Minkowski vacuum that one works with usually. But that's a separate point that is interesting. So now we go to the next slide. Okay, so since the background geometry is dynamical, then the sum of the uncertainties in QK and pi K, this field, are time dependent. They are not going to be minimum during the whole evolution. So the idea here is to consider the Planck regime that is shown by a time slab in this cartoon diagram here, and look at how the sigma square, this sum of uncertainties, varies in the Planck regime. And consider all states for which the sum of the uncertainties remains bounded by the supremum of sigma k square in the Planck regime. Okay? So in order to get this supremum of sigma k square, the evolution, the LQC dynamics is essential. One has to have a fixed background geometry. So by combining the ideas of wild curvature hypothesis and LQC dynamics, one gets a collection of state, or ball of state, that is bounded by this condition that the sigma k, the sum of uncertainties for all these states is bounded by the supremum. So now in the Planck regime, we have got a collection of states, but still there are infinite number of states here. We have to select one, or you know, one state out of it, out of these, which is more preferred. And for that, one looks at what happens during inflation. What happens during inflation regarding the uncertainties of these fields QK and pi K. So during inflation, the uncertainty in QK gets squeezed, and uncertainty in pi K gets elongated. Okay, and the uncertainty in QK going to getting squeezed is related to the classical emergence or emergence of the classical behavior from these quantum perturbations. So that gives us motivation to fix the choose a unique state out of these this ball of state as follows. So the Heisenberg state of the scalar mode QK is the one that minimizes the uncertainty in QK at the end of inflation. And it's very important that this minimization is done within this ball. Because if this this ball that is given by the condition that sigma k square is bounded by the supremum of sigma k square. Otherwise, if there was no such restriction, one could minimize the uncertainty in QK to completely go to zero, and there will be essentially no power spectrum. So it's very important that so the construction of this ball of state is essential to get a unique state. Okay? So now we go to the next slide. So far what we have done is we obtained a Planck scale extension of the background geometry in NQC. We fixed the background geometry by invoking a physical principle that used elements of observation in quantum geometry, and at the same time fix a unique state for perturbations. And after doing this, there is no free parameter in the theory. I mean, background is fixed and states for perturbations are fixed. And so in this whole analysis, as I also mentioned previously, we have looked at two phenomenological potential which are widely used in cosmology literature is the Starobinsky potential and quadratic potential, and the final results do not depend on the choice of the potential. And this can be understood by the fact that the field, the initial conditions are kinetic dominated, and in the Planck regime, potential doesn't really matter. And the second, that the principle two, the second principle, while fixing the number of e-folds between bounds and CMB, we just used the quantum geometry. We did not assume any infinity potential. So that's like one intuitive way to understand why the results do not depend so much on quadratic on choice of potential. However, the dynamics between bounds and CMB, and they do depend on potential, but the final predictions don't for scalar perturbations. Okay, so having all these frameworks set up for us, now we can go ahead and compute the power spectrum and what kind of observable prediction that we are going to get out of this framework. So let's do that and go to next slide. So here I show the scalar power spectrum that we obtain. So the dashed curve here, which says BD, BD is for Bunch Davis. So this is the power law, power spectrum that one usually gets in standard inflationary scenario. And LQC power spectrum is shown by these blue points. So what we do is we compute the power spectrum mode by mode. And for each mode, these scatter points show the two-point function in momentum space for each k. And if I join these points, you will see that there is a very high frequency oscillation happening with k. But what matters for observations? So, I mean, in observation, we don't see the power spectrum directly. What we see is the statistical properties of the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And for those statistical properties of the fluctuations in the CMB, what matters is the averaged out power spectrum, which one can obtain by binning the scattered power spectrum by taking a finite width, finite bin size. And I mean, we did analysis with both. We took the exact power spectrum and this binned power spectrum to compute the final results, and the final results remain invariant. Remain unchanged whether you do binning or not. Okay, and as I mentioned, this power spectrum can be computed for both potentials, but here I have chosen to show for Starobinsky potential, which is more favorite in cosmology. And as you can see, the value of phi bounds is fixed to some value using the principle one. So what do we learn from this power spectrum? We see that for large k, as you go to higher wave number, the power spectrum of loop quantum cosmology agrees very well with Bunch Davis. But for small k, which correspond to large scales, large long wavelength modes of perturbation, there is deviation between Bunch Davis and loop quantum cosmology, and there is, on an average, there is less power in LQC compared than what is predicted in the Bunch Davis power spectrum. So this gives us hope that somehow maybe this suppression can lead us to, or you know, can explain the origin of one of the CMB anomalies that we discussed in the beginning. So in order to see whether that is true or not, we need to compare, compute the statistical properties of the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And one can do that by evolving this power spectrum on this slide to the CMB surface. So we go to next slide. And in order to do that, since there is publicly available code called CAMB, one can modify the code to, you know, give the power spectrum that is coming from LQC and obtain the CL is the, basically the correlation with angular correlation between two points in this at two points in the CMB surface. And as you can see, the in the main figure, the predictions of standard inflation and LQC and Planck data agree very well for L larger than 30. But as you go, if you look at L less than 30, the bunch there are deviation between bunch Davis and LQC power spectrum, and LQC has less power actually. Okay, but just as, just by this, one cannot say that LQC is better. LQC is better than than bunch Davis. One has to do some statistical test, and for that, one can compute the chi-square, and in chi-square between the chi-square for the bunch Davis power spectrum and chi-square for the LQC power spectrum. So basically chi-square it quantifies how much difference there is between data and your theory. And it turns out that chi-square for LQC is slightly smaller than bunch Davis. That is, LQC provides better fit to data at these scales than the standard power spectrum. And the number that one is delta chi square is 3.15. And I mean, this, I should mention that this gain in the value of chi square is done at the cost of no free parameters. We have not added any free parameters. So this moderate value of chi square is actually good news. Okay, so far we have what we have done is we have seen that LQC power spectrum gives you suppression, which has already been seen by the Planck and WMAP data. Can we make more predictions that can be tested in the future observations? And for that, let's go to next slide. Slide 18. So what one can do is compute the polarization spectrum for E-mode polarization. And one sees, so the left, so there are two figures here on this slide. The left figure shows the E-mode polarization spectrum. And as you can see, for small Ls, there is a similar suppression predicted in LQC as compared to standard inflation. And similarly in the cross correlation between temperature and E-mode polarization spectrum in TE on the right figure here. So in standard cosmology, like there are other mechanisms to generate the suppression in the temperature anisotropy spectrum. For instance, late time effects such as integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect can also generate suppression at low Ls in temperature anisotropic spectrum. But these late time effects do not affect the E-mode polarization. Okay, so if this suppression, such kind of suppression in E-mode polarization is seen in future observations, hopefully Planck is supposed to release this low L polarization data next year, by mid next year. So if these features are seen in E-mode polarization, that would be a clear indication that this suppression effect is coming from some primordial physics, some early universe physics. And then if the data is more precise, one can go ahead and check how good the LQC predictions there are. Okay. Another important consequence of this suppression in E-mode has to do with the late time cosmology. So as you can see in the plot in the left plot here, there is a peak in the graph at low Ls. And peaks in various plots are always good in cosmology because one uses the position and the amplitude of these peaks as, you know, a standard ruler to you know, estimate various cosmological parameters. And it turns out that this peak at very low L in E-mode polarization is very much related to what the late time reionization history. That is, so the optical depth parameter, which quantifies essentially the time of reionization in the post-EMB era, is very sensitive to, I shouldn't say very sensitive, but it's sensitive enough to the position and the amplitude of this peak in the E-mode polarization. So since LQC predicts, well, LQC plus these two physical principles predict that the amplitude is suppressed, when the Planck data is released, we'll have something to say about the optical depth. That is, we'll put constraints on the value of this optical depth parameter using early universe cosmology, like quantum gravity era. So this is quite exciting, at least for me. It's very, very, very nice to realize that, quantum gravity effects not only can, affect CMB, but also late time parameters can also have, can be sensitive. And one can go back and forth to learn about theory from observation and learn about observation from theory. So this is a nice interplay. And this is how physics is done most of the time. So it's quite nice. So going to the next slide. So I would like to summarize here. So what we have seen essentially is kind of quantum gravity in the sky, because all the ideas from quantum gravity can be seen in these observations, which come from the sky. So in this talk, what I've done is used LQC framework plus two new principles to fix the background geometry and Heisenberg states for perturbations, which resulted in the fact that all the freedom in the theory is fixed. There are no free parameter. And as a consequence, what one gets is that suppression of power at very large scales in the CMB. And not only suppression, but also the fact that the suppression agrees better with the data than standard inflation. So there is another mechanism within LQC proposed by Ivan Aguyo, which comes from a different, slightly different path. And Ivan Aguyo's mechanism also gives a suppression in power. So for that, you should see Ivan's previous talk, previous ILKG talk. So in this talk, we have also seen that one can make testable predictions for future observations and potentially interesting effects for late time cosmology. And then using all these framework and observation, there is a nice interplay between fundamental theory and observation. Go to next slide. So before any talk, I would like to just mention one phenomenological thing, exploration. So in this talk, what I did was fix the freedom in the background initial condition by asking that there's a simplest quantum geometry at the bounds, and that fixes the size of this ever observable CMB sphere at the bounds. Okay. But from a phenomenological perspective, I can ask, okay, let me not use that principle for a moment, and ask what are observations telling us about the size of this CMB sphere at this ever observable CMB sphere at the bounds. So in order to do that, so this is completely phenomenological exploration, just to test the robustness of this principle. So what we did was to make this size of this CMB2 sphere at the bounds a free parameter, and run Monte Carlo simulations by comparing the predictions of LQC with observations. And what one sees, what one obtains in the end, is this posterior probability distribution of this parameter. So now RB is a free parameter, and RB naught is the value that was fixed by the by principle one that we used a few slides back. So it's quite interesting to see that this analysis shows that the value of RB, the most preferred value of RB from observation, is around one Planck length, and what we got from our principle is 1.57. Furthermore, this 1.57 that we fixed RB naught is within the 68% confidence limit of the best fit value. And given that every measurement that we have from observation, be it Planck, WMAP, or anything, they have the error bars are 68 are at the level of 68%. So within the allowed error bar, our principle one gives a value which is compatible with observation. So this somehow shows that there is a robustness in fixing this value of RB at the bounds, and observations do prefer it somehow. Okay, so finally, I would like to say that, of course, it may happen that when Planck releases data next year, one doesn't see a suppression. So if one doesn't see a suppression, so that would be like a falsifiable scenario. That if one doesn't see suppression in the E-mode polarization, one can then say that at least one of the ingredients that we used has to be revisited somehow. So in that sense, like it's a good semiotic interplay between observation and theory, that if observations tell something that predictions are wrong, then one has to go and revisit the theory. So with that final note, I would like to stop here. Thank you. Yes.
Two questions.
Questions?
Yeah, there is a question here.
If you have primordial gravitational waves measured, which is not successful yet because of dust, my system, then tensor spectral index, AT, if the ratio scale of the tensor, they learn. How does your calculation affect this? How does it affect the tensor part, the gravitational waves?
Okay, good. So the question here is that if one computes the power spectrum for tensor modes, how will the predictions for the tensor to scalar ratio and the spectral index for tensor perturbation will change? Okay. So if we use the same principle for tensor perturbations as well, which we will, we'll turn out that for exact calculation, one has to revisit and do the calculation, but the expectation is that the value of R, the tensor to scalar ratio, will not change, because what one will see that there'll be a similar suppression in tensor modes as well. So these suppression in tensor and suppression in scalar may cancel out, and the ratio may remain the same. However, since there will be suppression at large scales, NT will not be a constant. NT will change with time.
It runs.
It runs in a nonlinear way. And one can look at the slow roll consistency relationship that relates R, NT, NS, and so on. So the consistency relation is going to be modified. And so if we have a way to measure that deviation of consistency relationship, that will be another way to test whether these predictions.
So time for another question.
Yes, there's another question here.
Yes,
sorry. Jorge, are there other questions?
Yeah,
Go ahead.
Sorry, I have a question.
Okay.
Yes, Amber, sorry, maybe you said it. Can you remind us how you fix the value of the barrel music parameter?
Because that goes into the area gap.
Okay, so the we take the barbaric emissivity parameter from the black hole entropy calculations done like a decade ago by Meissner, Domagala, and Lewandowski, and so on. So we just take that value, and we trust that that value is.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no
questions.
So, if there are no more questions, there is a question locally here.
Yeah, if you take classical chi, you can get a burst if you violate one of the positive energy conditions. So, you get a burst, okay? Now, do you violate a positive energy condition?
Okay.
Burst.
Okay. So, the question is, in classical GR, one can obtain bounces or classical bounds by violating positive energy conditions in the matter field. And the question is, are we also doing that in LQC? The answer is no. We do not violate any standard energy condition. This bounce is coming purely from quantum geometrical effects, and the matter sector satisfies all the standard energy conditions. So the standard scalar field, standard kinetic term, you can get a bounce.
More questions? So I have one. In the original work of Ivan Abai and Bill Nelson, the value of the inflet on the bounce was a free parameter. What fixed is it here?
Yeah, so here the value of free parameter bounce is fixed by the principle one, essentially. So in their previous work, if you change the value of phi bounds, that actually changes the number of e-folds between the bounds till today, right? But here, we have fixed that number of e-folds from bounds till today. So that actually fixes the value of the infleton field, the bounds. Okay.
Yeah, so just to continue, Jorge, this is Abai. So the point is that if you go to slide number 9, then you can see that current observations tell us the history to the future of the CMB, and we don't know what the history is going to be to the past of CMB, and direct observations will not tell us that because we don't see the direct observations past of CMB. And so, but we do know that whatever the ball is, which reaches the radius of 17.29 megaparsecs at the CMB surface, if you go back, then that the radius of that ball is going to keep shrinking. This we know anyway. And the question is, what is it at the bounce? Right? That is the question. And what this principle is saying is that, well, maybe what we should do is to take the quantum geometry and the area operator that we learned about extremely seriously and determine the size using this quantum geometry. And the statement is that if you do that, then two things happen. One is the value of the principle does not refer to inflation, but if you're given a particular inflation model, then the value of phi b is fixed, and that for large class of models, which include Sorbinsky and m squared phi squared, the bounce is also kinetic energy dominated. So that the whole thing is fixed by this. And then finally, as Rajesh pointed out in his last slide, if one were to take a point of view, well, but maybe the size of this ball should have been something else, maybe your fundamental principle is incorrect, then one can just treat this as a phenomenological question. Let the size of the ball be a free parameter and fit the data, and we find that the value you get is very close to the value that we obtain from quantum geometry. So in both these principles, there is actually interplay between what is happening at the Planck scale and what is happening at late time. And this is the interplay that is sort of seems to be coming up here. Whether this is something that is a fundamental feature or whether this is something that's a stepping stone is far from being clear. But as a stepping stone, it seems to be working, to be doing several independent things for us, which we did not expect.
Thank you.
What is the prior you took for the size of the balance?
So we took the flat prior, essentially. So
extending to?
Extending to all, as you can see, in the if you go to last slide 21, or 20, slide 20. So we took a prior from like point, actually 0.04 all the way till 5. It's a flat prior, and I don't show 5 because for larger than 3, the posterior goes to 0. It is very much suppressed there. So I played around with prior quite a bit just to test the robustness of that, so that the final results don't actually depend on your choice of prior. So, yeah. Yes.
In principle one, you said that we fixed two values, the Hubble scale and the omega from observational values. So does you don't count that as three parameters of the theory that are determined by the theory itself, but do we actually need to fix them by observations, or can we get them from more mathematical principles?
Yeah. So the question is, in getting the principle one, that's on slide 9, I said that value of H naught, Hubble parameter, omega matter, and omega lambda are these, and we get from observation. The question is, can we fix these values from mathematical principle? And the answer is no, because mathematical principle gives you a set of framework, set of equations, but those equations have some free parameters. These are the free parameters in those equations. And to correspond, for that framework to correspond to our observable universe, H naught, omega matter, and omega lambda has to take a particular value. And that particular value can only be determined by comparing your framework with observations.
You measure H naught locally. To Adam Rees' new paper, the local value at register zero is bigger by 3.5 sigma than the CLP.
That value.
Attention.
Yeah. So that value is not too much different from 67.
Yeah,
it's on 72 or something.
It's 73.
It's a small error. It's a small error, but so that small difference from 67 to 73 is not going to change much of the results. They may change slightly here and there, but I don't expect them to change too much. Yes, there's another question here.
So why did you use a Q? What principle did you use to choose that, and could you choose something else, and why not?
Right. So, again, this construction is...
Can you please repeat it?
Yeah, so the question is that in selecting principle two, in order to select the Heisenberg state, if you go to slide number... you're asking a cube. I see. I had a completely different. Okay, so slide number 10. The question is, what led you to choose a cubical graph? So the answer is that we are working with the simplest quantum geometry that we can have, and that the simplest graph that one works with is the cubical graph here. Do you have something else in mind?
One can
do tetrahedron. And if you do tetrahedron, instead of having a 6 valent node, you'll have 4 valent node, right? So the area of this S2B, instead of being 30, it will be 20, because it's just 3/2. And that will give you the value of RB. RB naught, instead of 1.57, it will be 1.2 approximately. Right.
Oh,
1.2. So that is, and that is going to not change things very much, because that will be that will amount to change in number of fee foldings about 0.1 or so, and
less than 0.1.
less than 0.1, and so that is not going to change much. And actually, the answer to your question is kind of in the last slide, slide 20, where we saw this posterior distribution, and the peak was at RV equal to 1, and 1.57 was already in the 68%. So if you took 1.2, that is, so within this error bar, these ambiguities are taken care.
And just so, because these are gravity people, are like small people, the numbers that were used, like for the Hubble parameter and various things, to construct, to arrive at the radius, at the last radius of the sphere at the last scattering surface to be equal to 17.9 megaparsecs, those things were all calculated using the mean values and not worrying about the error bars, because you can keep it, but it just sort of becomes very, you know, very. And so there's always some flexibility here. And, you know, the whole thing has this 68% error. One should not trust it more than that anyway. The entire calculation that we're talking about should not be trusted more than the 68% error bars.
Yeah. So.
Sorry, in terms of the final graph, when you compare with the experiments, how much difference would a 20 versus 31 make?
How much difference? So by final graph, you mean at CL power spectrum on the slide 17. Slide 17. Yeah, so from 30 to 20 Planck-Lin square, the graph is not going to change much. I would say it will be on this graph. If I plot those two things, it will be practically indistinguishable.
Okay.
Because that will change the scale very slightly. So right now we are seeing the suppression for L less than 30. There we might see suppression for L less than 29 or 28 or something very close.
Okay.
Essentially, because these numbers are very close, 1.57 and 1.2 are not too much.
Yeah, to me at least, because I come both from a mathematical background, the non-triviality is not, I mean, of course, it's very non-trivial. There is power separation, and one can test with experiments and observations and all that, and that might actually lead us to deeper the results in quantum gravity. But the very fact that one can actually start in the Planck domain without any free parameters and produce a power spectrum which essentially agrees even for bigger than 30 with what inflation does by starting at completely general relativity energy. So in the 12 orders of magnitude curve which is involved between the Planck domain and the onset of inflation, where standard inflationary scenario starts, the fact that one can just do this starting from the Planck regime itself, I think, from the point of view of quantum gravity, is quite non-trivial. The fact that you get power suppression is a bonus, in my view. The fact that you get you are not ruled out immediately by starting out of the Planck domain is, I think, already a sort of an interesting fact.
Okay, there are no more questions. Thanks, Brajesh, again.
Thank you. Thanks, Jorge.
I did not.
They want to calculate the classic
ask the question.
The difference is not vision.
Just didn't even know quite something.
Yeah, but
yeah, my time.
The point of view is that if you go to plan Beijing, you should not trust Vasil Jiyan anymore. Like, just as like you when you look at atoms.
No, I agree. Not,
yeah.
But the fact is we don't know.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean officially maybe we don't know, but there are strong theoretical reasons to
one way to have decided. Primordial gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
You can see right down to the Well, nature can do that sometimes. It makes it difficult for us. There's a lot of... We really do not understand cosmology yet.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There are a lot of things that we take. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions in there, like you said, that we have used a part of view works at large scale and so on, and we are trusting that a part of view works.
Yeah, which is fine.
Yeah.
You make assumptions and you get this result, which is interesting. The problem is that this fit to the angular power spectrum, which is remarkable, six, eight parameters.
Mm-hmm.
You have to assume that dark matter exists, which has not been measured.
Yeah.
And you have to assume that you understand dark energy.
We don't assume that we understand dark energy, just assume that it's there.
Cosmologists take the parameters omega m, dark matter, omega lambda, six parameters. Fit the data. And the cosmologist says, I don't care about where dark energy comes from.
Yeah. That's the logical point of view, yeah.
And I don't care that where the dark matter is, or I don't worry about that. I just fit the data. Look at what I fit. But this is not the way you do physics. You have to understand fundamentally.
Right, I mean, but a lot of times the guidance to fundamental theory comes from these
conditions. The problem is that it hasn't guided us. There are F of R modified gravities. There are huge numbers. There's lambda, but there's the fine tuning of the cosmological constant, 10 to the power of 22. Yeah. I have a model called void cosmology, which I published. 300 or more papers that came out of that void cosmology. But what is being said is that we sit in a void, and we see voids, by the way, in the mid-time universe. And the light comes through the void from the supernova. And the curvature inside the void is negative, whereas in the overdense region outside, it's positive. So when light comes through a negative curvature of space-time, it diverges.
Mm-hmm.
Geodesics diverge. And it looks as if the supernova are farther away, but they're not. So there is no dark energy. And the universe is not accelerated. But you see, the void is, the bubble is embedded in the FRW universe as a target.
But does it satisfy other constraints?
There are arguments about how well it fits and so on, but this is an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
But the basic result is that it fits the power spectrum. So I can argue that we really do not yet understand cosmology.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a totally different statement.
Right. Yeah, probably. Yeah, me too, definitely. But we have come a long way. Like we have.
Oh, well, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
In 1922, we were still thinking that we sat inside one galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Now you have this picture there, the post, but this is incredible.
Yeah, exactly. That's
But we still do not completely understand what we're doing.
That's really true in some sense. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree completely. We have to work harder and
nice talk.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like it.